So I think that some of you might recognize this picture. So what this picture is trying to show is the distribution of clients of the Klarna botnet, which was launched last year by an anonymous researcher who managed to gain control over about 420,000 embedded clients without too much of a problem. So of course I cannot endorse this kind of research, but it does show the state of the embedded device security that we have today. So what we see in general is that more and more smaller and smaller embedded devices want to gain network connectivity. And they also want to support third-party extensibility of the software that they run. But unfortunately, as of yet, no effective solutions exist to deal with the new threats that this remote extensibility brings. Of course, this problem is known, and therefore, recent years have shown some interest from the research community. Okay, with this in mind, our goal was to design and implement a low-cost, extensible security architecture. And we set for ourselves three main goals, the first of which is to provide strong isolation for software modules that are running on the device. And it should provide strong isolations in the presence of remote third-party extensibility. A second goal is to provide secure communication and remote attestation of software running on a specific node. And here for us, secure communication means to be able to communicate authenticated with modules running on the node, as well as to prove the integrity of messages that you receive from modules. And we want to support this both locally and remotely. And locally means communicate between modules running on the same node. And a third major goal we set for ourselves is to provide these guarantees in the presence of an attacker who has full control over the infrastructural software running on the device. And this means that we do not want to have any software in the trusted computing base of our system. So we want to have a zero software trusted computing base providing the previous two features. Now the system model that we target in our design is a very generic one, in which there is an infrastructure provider who owns and manages a number of nodes. And on these nodes, there are software providers who want to install software modules. And as you can see, on one specific node, there are multiple different software providers who can install software modules alongside each other. So this is a very generic model. It is applicable to both the largest cloud-based systems as well as the smallest wireless sensor network systems. But in our research, we mainly focus on the low end of this spectrum. So this means devices like wireless sensor networks that run on processors like the MSP430 that do not provide any security guarantees at all in hardware. So there's no virtual memory, no protective rings whatsoever. To give a small example of such a node, here's a node in gray to which a sensor is attached, and there's a driver module, SMS, that can communicate with this sensor. And there are different software providers that will install software modules on this node that will gather sensor data through the driver module, transform this data, and send it back to their software providers. Okay, given this background, I will present Sankus, which is a low-cost security architecture for embedded devices that effectively deals with remote third-party extensibility. And I will start with explaining how the isolation of modules is accomplished in Sankus. Then I will talk about key management, which will be the foundation for providing remote attestation and secure communication. Then I will talk about the last feature that we provide, which is secure linking. And secure linking is defined by us as the secure local communication between modules running on the same node. And I will conclude with some results. So for the module isolation, I will first explain how modules are represented in Sankus, and then I will explain the access rights enforcements. So in Sankus, modules are basically simple binary files which contain two mandatory sections. The first section is the public text section, which contains all the codes that should be executed at runtime by the module, as well as any compile time constants. And the second section is the protected data section. And the protected data section contains all the data, all the runtime data that should be protected or should be confined to this module. So only the module should be able to access this data. To illustrate this, this diagram depicts a Sankus-enabled node in which there is one module loaded, which is highlighted in this picture. And as you can see, both the protected data section and the public text section are located in memory. Before I continue, I should explain some terminology that I will use throughout the rest of this presentation. The first is that of a module layout. And the layout of module are the load addresses of the public text section and the protected data section. So these are four values, the start and end addresses of both sections. The second concept is that of the identity of a module. And we define the identity of a module as a combination of the layout of this module with the contents of the public text section. And this this means that the identity of a module will uniquely identify a given module as it is loaded on a specific node. Now, there are also some other things visible on this diagram. First, there is an entry point, the first part of the text section. And also, there are some keys visible, which are stored in the protected storage area. But this will all become clear in a moment. Now, we isolate modules by using a program counter-based memory access control mechanism. And this means that the access writes for a specific memory location are variable based on the current value of the program counter. Now, to illustrate this, I will fill in the following table, in which the from part will indicate where the current program counter is located. So the program counter can either be in the text section of a module or in any other section, which can be the text section of another module or just plain unprotected memory. And the to part of this table will indicate which section is currently being accessed by the current instruction. And then the cells in this table will indicate the access rights that are enforced by Senkos. Okay, and the first and most important part is the isolation of data. And Senkos makes sure that the protected data section of a module is only accessible when the program counter is currently executing in the public text section of a module. So this means that only a module itself is allowed to access its private data. Another important part that is enforced by Senkos is a protection against some forms of code misuse. So for example, an attacker might try to find some gadgets in the text section of a module and combine them into extracting protected data from the protected data section. And to prevent this, Senkos will enforce that the public text section of a module is only executable if the program counter is currently already within the text section of the same module. And this ensures that attackers cannot simply try to jump to specific gadgets found in the protected text section. Of course, we need a way to enter a module, because otherwise it would be completely useless to the rest of the system. And that's where the entry point comes in. So the first instruction in the public text section of each module is called the entry point. And the entry point itself has exactly the same rights as the rest of the text section, so it's allowed to read and write the protected data section. However, from outside the module, the entry point is executable. And this means we have a controlled way to enter a module. There's a single instruction that we can use to start executing code in a module. Okay, to finish this table, we also have parts outside of modules, which we call unprotected memory. And unprotected memory is simply completely accessible to the whole system. Okay, we need a way to enable or disable the isolation of modules. And recall that the layout of a module is stored in a protected storage area. And this layout information is then used by the access control system to enforce the policies I've just described. But of course, we cannot just hard code these values in the hardware, because that would make Senkos very inflexible. And that's why we added two instructions. The first instruction is the protect instruction, which will get as a first parameter the layout information of the memory locations that should be isolated. And if this instruction finishes, the isolation will be enabled at a given layout. Notice that there is a second parameter, SP, but what this is for will become clear when I start talking about key management. And the second instruction is called unprotect, and this will disable the protection of the module that invoked this instruction. So this means that only a module itself is able to disable the isolation of its memory locations. Okay, then to key management, which will form the foundations for remote attestation and secure communication. And the end goal for our key management scheme is to establish a shared secret between a software provider and one of his modules. And this shared secret will then be used to provide the secure communication primitives that we want. One of the first design decisions that we made was to only use symmetric crypto, because public key crypto is still too expensive to implement on the low cost nodes that we try to target with Sankus. And another goal for our key management scheme is to provide flexibility. And this means that a software provider should be able to deploy new software modules without the infrastructure provider having to intervene. So of course, there will be some initial registration process, but after this registration, the software provider should be able to deploy new nodes on its own. Okay, to this end, we have devised a hierarchical key derivation scheme. And first and for all, the infrastructure provider is the trusted party in all key management. And this means that the infrastructure provider will either have access to all the keys or is able to derive all the keys that are used in Sankus. Then the first level of keys are the so-called node keys or node master keys, which are generated at random whenever a node is manufactured, and the infrastructure provider will have access to all the node master keys of the nodes that it owns. The second level of keys are the software provider keys. And these are derived from a node master key given the ID of a software provider. So when the software provider registers itself with a infrastructure provider, it will get a unique ID, and the infrastructure provider will then derive a software provider key from this ID. Now, given the software provider key, the software provider can itself derive a third level of keys called the software module keys. And these keys are derived from the software provider keys given the identity of modules as diversification data. Now recall that I said in a previous slide that the identity of modules will uniquely identify a module loaded on a specific node. And this means that since the module keys are derived from the identity of modules, that the module keys itself will uniquely identify a specific module. Also note in this diagram that both the node master key and the software module key for each currently protected module are stored in the protected storage area. And the calculation of software module keys all happens within the protect instruction. So the second parameter here is the identification number of the software provider that is loading this module. And the protect instruction will then first derive the software provider key from its own node master key, and then derive from the software provider key the module key for the module that is currently being protected. And this module key is then stored in a protected storage area. Okay, given the scheme management scheme, I can now go on to secure communication. And the concept that we built upon is that the ability to use a specific module key proves the integrity and isolation of a software module deployed by a specific software provider on a specific node. And why is this? Well, there are three reasons for this. The first is that only a node and the software provider can calculate a specific module key. And a node can calculate it because it has access to the node master key. And of course, the software provider has access to the software provider key. Of course, the infrastructure provider is also able to do that, to do the same thing, but he's the trusted party. So this is implicit in the rest of the explanation here. A second thing is that the module key is only calculated after the isolation has been enabled. So the protect instruction will first enable isolation and then calculate the necessary keys. And this means that if the isolation has not been enabled, there simply is no key to use. And if the integrity of a module has not been protected before it has been isolated, the wrong key will be used by the module. Okay, and a third reason is that only a specific software module is allowed to use its own key. And this is enforced through special instructions that I will explain next. Okay, so how does secure communication work? Well, in the first step, the software provider will send some input to the nodes containing its software module. It will also add a nonce to provide some freshness guarantees. The software module, after receiving the input, will probably calculate some output O, and it will then send back this output together with a message authentication code calculated over the nonce, the input, and the output, using the key of using its own module key. And this MAC is calculated using a new MAC seal instruction, which will use the key of the module calling the instruction. And this ensures that only this module is only a module is allowed to use its own key. Any other module will simply be is simply not able to access the key of other modules. Now, of course, the software provider can, upon receiving this message, can recalculate the MAC, because he knows the correct software module key that should have been used by its module. Now, recall from previous slides that the module key is calculated after enabling isolation, and only a module itself is allowed to use its own key. So this provides some trust in the authenticity of messages, because only a software module is able to calculate the correct message authentication code. Okay, using secure communication, we can also provide remote attestation. For remote attestation, the things we want to achieve is the attestation of integrity, isolation, and liveliness of software modules. Now, recall from the secure communication explanation that integrity and isolation is provided or attested by the calculation of a MAC. The liveliness is attested by including a nonce in the MAC. So this means that remote attestation is actually a subset of secure communication. So if we only want to provide remote attestation, we can simply send a nonce to the node and let the software module calculate a MAC of this nonce and send it back to the software provider. Okay, then to the last feature provided by Sankus, which is secure linking. And secure linking is a secure local communication between modules. So what we want to do whenever one module wants to call a function of another module, it wants to verify that it is the correct software module. It's the integrity of the software module has been protected, and it is currently being isolated. Well, this is inherently different from secure communication, because in this case, we can have local communication between modules belonging to different software providers. And this means that there is no shared secret to work with. However, we do have a protected local state, and this will give rise to an interesting optimization. So how does it work? I will illustrate this by explaining the case where module A wants to call module B. And the first step is that A is deployed with a MAC of B's identity using A's key. And recall that the identity of a module is a combination of its layout and the contents of its public text section. This MAC can be deployed in unprotected memory because a MAC should be unforgeable. So it doesn't need any additional protection from the hardware. Now, whenever A wants to call B, it will start with calculating the MAC of B's actual identity. So the identity of B as how it is loaded currently on the node. And if this MAC of this identity matches with the MAC that A has been deployed with, he can safely call module B. Now, this verification of MACs is done through a new instruction called MAC verify. And the reason that we need a new instruction is that not only do we need to ensure that the integrity of, do we need to ensure that the MACs are the same, we also need to ensure that the module B that we want to call is actually being isolated. And this is what MAC verify is for. So it will first verify that the memory location that we want to call is actually being isolated, and then verify that the MAC of its identity corresponds with a given MAC. Of course, if we need to calculate a MAC every time we need to call a function of another module, this can become very expensive. But fortunately, we only need to do this once. Because after we have initially verified a module, if we can get some insurance that the same module is still being isolated at the same location, we don't need to verify it again, because we already verified it, and we can simply call it immediately. So how does it work in Sankus? Well, Sankus will assign unique IDs to each module that it protects, and it will ensure that the same ID is never reused throughout a boot cycle. And MAC verify will then return the ID of the verified module if the verification succeeds, and this ID can then be stored in the protected local state. Then, whenever any subsequent calls to the same module needs to be made, we can use yet another new instruction called getID, which will simply return the ID of the module located at a given location. And if this ID matches with the ID that has been stored in the protected local state, we know that we have already verified this module, so we don't need to do it again. Okay, then I'll finish with some results. So we provide a complete implementation of the Sankus architecture based on the OpenMSP 430 project, which is, as the name implies, an open source implementation of TI's MSP 430 architecture. For the secure communication, we built upon existing cryptographic primitives. So for message authentication codes, we use HMAC. For a key derivation function, we use HKDF. And these two are actually quite a good match because HKDF is based on HMAC, which means we can share a lot of hardware between our implementation of message authentication codes and key derivation functions. Of course, HMAC is based on a hash function, so we also need to implement that. And for this, we've chosen to use a recently proposed Pungent hash function. And we've chosen this hash function because it's one of the most lightweight hash functions as published to date. And we use the 128 bits version of Spongent, which means that all the keys that are used by Sankus are 128 bits wide. Okay, so our implementation is usable both in an RTL simulator as well as an FPGA, which means it's very easy to test software running on Sankus. Of course, to actually run software, we need to compile it. And compiling modules in a secure way for the Sankus architecture actually has quite a few intricacies. So for example, the runtime stack should always be placed in the protected data section, because otherwise local variables might leak to unprotected memory, or attackers might be able to manipulate control data like the return address on the stack. So this can be avoided by placing the runtime stack in the protected data section. Also, the necessary register should be cleared whenever a module is exited, because otherwise protected data might leak through these registers. And also, since we only have one physical entry point into each module, and this is very inconvenient for programmers, we need a way to actually support multiple logical entry points through a single physical entry point. And so we provide a fully automatic compiler that transparently deals with all these issues. And from a programmer's point of view, there are only three annotations that he should use for creating a Sankus-enabled module. So there are annotations for putting data in the protected data section, for using functions as internal functions of the public text sections, and for indicating that functions should be entry points into the modules. Okay, as for the runtime overhead, so for any normal code that doesn't make use of any of the secure communication features of Sankus, there's no overhead at all, and this is because our hardware extensions do not affect the critical path of the processor, so the maximum frequency of the programmer is not affected as well. The main overhead incurred by Sankus is that of calculating MACs. So whenever a module needs to be verified or output data needs to be sent, a MAC needs to be calculated, and this will incur some overhead. And there's also a smaller overhead due to entry and exit code from modules. So whenever the stacks need to be switched or registers need to be cleared, there is a small overhead there. Now, to quantify this, we've configured a processor in the following example. So we have a sensor module that will be able to talk with a sensor attached to the node. And there's an SP1 who installs a software module, SM1, that will gather some sensor data, do some transformations on it, and sends the output data back. The overhead induced by Sankus is fixed. So we have an overhead whenever SMS needs to be verified by SM1. Only the first time, because the second time the GetID optimization can be used. And we have an overhead when SM1 needs to calculate the MAC of its output data. Now note that this overhead is fixed. It's fixed for a given input size and output size. And this means that relative overhead of Sankus will actually depend on the amount of transformations that is done in SM1. And this is illustrated in the following picture. This shows the relative overhead of Sankus for a given number of cycles of computations done by SM1. And as you can see, if there's no computation done, the overhead is quite large, but it quickly drops whenever the module starts to do some useful computation on the data. And also note that the overhead for the first invocation of this benchmark is much higher than the overhead for any subsequent invocations due to the GetID optimization. Then for the area overhead, we have a fixed overhead of about 600 registers, 1200 LUTs in our FPGA implementation, and this is mainly due to the implementation of the MAC and the key derivation function. And for each additional module that needs to be supported in our system, we have an additional overhead of about 200 registers and 300 LUTs, mainly due to key storage. Okay, to conclude, I have presented Sankus, which is a low-cost security architecture that deals with remote third-party extensibility. We provide module isolation through program counter-based access control. We have a hierarchical key management scheme which derives keys based on the identity of modules. We provide remote attestation and secure communication through the ability to use a specific key. We also provide secure local communication, which we call secure linking, based on the verification of MACs of the identities of modules. And for the results, we provide a simulator and FPGA implementation and automatic compilation. And all the results are available open source from the following URL. Thank you.
Jay Anjang, Microsoft Research. So I'm curious to hear a little bit about your key revocation schemes. So if key like N and SP, if that's compromised, then how can you detect this, and then what kind of key revocation process that you support?
Well, we don't really have a good revocation process. We have no automatic way to detect the compromise of keys. But it depends on which key is compromised on how we can handle it. If it's a module key, it's local to this one module, and we can, for example, redeploy this module with a random byte appended to its text section. And this means a new key will be used by this module. If a software provider key is compromised, the software provider can be provided a new ID. And this way he will get a new key. But it just means that he has to redeploy all his modules. And if a module key, if a node key is compromised, we simply need to replace the node because it's hard-coded in a node. So it needs to be replaced.
Very, very interesting talk, Jeremy Epstein, National Science Foundation. Two questions. First, with regard to your statement that there is no TCB, I would argue that, in fact, you have a hardware TCB, mm-hmm. and that TCB protects against certain types of attacks, but not others. For example, if one of these modules had a scripting language embedded in it, then potentially you could get around the TCB, so to speak, with that scripting language. Would you agree or disagree with that? So that's the first question. And my second question is, did you compare the module protection architecture you have with any of the systems that were built in the 1960s and 1970s, which used a very similar architecture on processors that functioned at a fraction of a megahertz and had exactly these same properties?
On your first question, I completely agree with this. Mm-hmm. So the trusted computing base, that's what we mean with this, a hardware-only trusted computing base is that the only thing that implicitly needs to be trusted by a module is the hardware. Of course, the software of the module itself also needs to be trusted. Mm-hmm. So if there's a bug, a buffer overflow in the module itself, it can be exploited. It might be exploited by an attacker. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we don't do anything to prevent this. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that you can split the security critical parts of your application in small modules, mm-hmm. for which it can be feasible to formally verify the correctness of these modules. Mm-hmm. Does this answer your question?
I think I would argue that you're claiming, I mean, it's true there's no software in the box that's the TCB. There is still software there is sort of. I don't know, I think you're claiming more than you've got is I guess, I'm not saying it's not useful. I think it's just an overly broad claim. Anyway, and your thought on older architectures, the recreating what was done 40 years ago?
But I'm actually not completely sure what architectures you were talking about. So.
Well, things like the GE 645 and the Burroughs 5000, 6000, 7000 series, a lot of those had a lot of these same protections to prevent you from calling into random places in memory.
Well, I'm not familiar with these architectures, unfortunately, okay. So I would have to look into this. Okay.
I'd suggest that you might learn from history.
Sure, thanks.
Jethro Beekman, UC Berkeley. Do you have a way to make sure that modules are not modified before they're loaded into memory or will start executing?
No, there's no way to actively prevent this, but it will be detected because whenever a module is modified before the isolation is enabled, the key used by this module will be different, and the software provider can detect the fact that a different key is used, that something has gone wrong in the deployment process.
Okay. Thanks.